All right. Welcome, 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 everyone. Ladies, gentlemen, and everyone in between, this is Tony's Political Ramblings. So, today, this episode is literally based off of an advertisement I got in the mail the other day for the Shen Yun, concert and dance presentation that goes on, and they travel across the United States and they perform this sort of traditional Chinese dance show. I haven't seen it yet, so I'm not entirely sure what's involved. But it looks like a lot of dancing and orchestral music and things of that nature, pulling on more of an ancient Chinese image to sell and to get people in the seats. And what's interesting about Shen Yun is, and I know this through my extensive research and learning about much of East Asia and really modern China, is that this is not an apolitical entity. And I think I'm going to highlight Shen Yun here to sort of underscore this point that everything is political. Everything is inherently political. Everything about this world that we live in reflects values, judgments, and policies put in place by some people to determine really the frameworks that other people live their lives in. And so Shen Yun, if you look at the back of the flyer that I received, I'm looking at it, I have it in my hands right now. It says at the very bottom, it says presented by the Falun Dafa Association. And so what is that? What is the Falun Dafa Association? The Falun Dafa Association is the sort of larger organization for Falun Gong, which is a meditation practice or heretical cult, depending on who you ask, that was really popular in the People's Republic of China in the 80s and 90s. And so I think it's important for me to just go back and tell the story behind Shen Yun, Falun Dafa, and Falun Gong, and really how we got here. So the story begins in 1949. The Chinese Civil War has just ended, and the Chinese Communist Party, led by Mao Zedong, won the war. And now they are the official governing body of the People's Republic of China, which was mainland China. And the losing side, the Kuomintang, led by Chiang Kai-shek, is now living on Taiwan, a small, really, compared to the rest of China, a microscopic size island compared to the rest of Chinese territory that is now run by the Chinese Communist Party. And so this movement called Qigong, which is a sort of physical meditation, it's very similar to Tai Chi, that sort of thing where you sort of stand and move different parts of your body. Qigong as a movement sort of started to pick up steam in the 1950s because many of the people realized that it was put forth by the medical community, specifically the Chinese traditional Chinese medicine community in mainland China, as a sort of way of keeping traditional Chinese practices alive in the modern socialist or communist China. And so this obviously didn't last very long, especially if you know anything about modern Chinese history. Anything from the past was deemed corrupt, it was deemed evil and immoral, and it was abruptly cut off, censored, and destroyed. And that's why much of Chinese culture prior to 1949, you find that in other countries. You find it in Japan, you'll find it in Taiwan, you'll find it in Canada. I remember I went to a museum in Canada, and There were all kinds of ancient Chinese exhibits that, again, would have been destroyed during the Cultural Revolution in the 1960s, where a lot of traditional books, statues, temples, practices were all gutted and destroyed. And so, and Qigong was one of these things that was banned in the 1960s during the Cultural Revolution. And so individuals weren't really allowed to practice it anymore. And so it sort of went underground. And so Qigong, which initially came as a movement to preserve traditional Chinese culture, was now forced underground in the modern in modern China. And so at the end of the 1970s, after very, very big famines and millions of deaths, Mao Zedong dies, and he is no longer in power and no longer running the People's Republic of China. And who steps in is Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping is a very important man in modern Chinese history. He is fundamentally his regime, not regime, but his administration and his running of the Chinese Communist Party is what put China in the situation where it is today. He started what in Chinese is called the Gaige Kaifang, which is the open door policy. And he basically opened up the People's Republic of China to foreign countries for trade, international collaboration in terms of businesses. And he opened up special economic zones, which are basically free market capitalism type systems within the largest communist Chinese political and economic system. And so those are cities like Shenzhen that have just blown up in the last, not literally blown up, but have had huge waves of economic and economic development in the last, 50 years because of these reforms put in place by Deng Xiaoping. And so from that point on, there was a sort of more of an open policy in the Chinese Communist Party and in the People's Republic of China on the whole. That was sort of socialism with a Chinese twist. That was the name. The slogan. That was really the slogan and the idea moving forward in the 70s and 80s and the 90s. And with that came a lot of other sort of liberalization and relaxation of certain Mao-era restrictions. And particularly you saw this come up politically. There were a lot more opportunities for people to participate politically than before. And the return of Qigong and Falun Gong was another thing that dovetailed with that rise in more active vocal political participation. And this, again, this went all the way through the end of the 80s, which the end of the 80s in general was a very, very big moment. The fall of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Berlin Wall happened towards the late 80s into the 90s. You saw South Korea overthrew its military dictators. You had Taiwan that overthrew and established democracy in 1988, 1989. Like I said, same was true in South Korea. And many of the Eastern European countries associated with the Soviet Union started establishing democracies. And so I would have supposed that around this time as well in the People's Republic of China, there was this sort of sentiment that, why not us? And so that's when you have massive democracy organizing and protests and movements that end in the Tiananmen Square massacre, where the Chinese government opened fire on its own citizens who were asking for its own opportunity to run itself. The Chinese people would run its government, not the Chinese Communist Party. And so again, this Falun Gong kind of went around with that as well. And so Falun Gong was this sort of this movement that had a lot of people and it garnered a lot of support across the nation. And it was seen as a threat to national security, stability, and the Chinese Communist Party on the whole. And so what ended up happening was, is throughout the 90s, the Chinese Communist Party started to push back against Falun Gong as a movement. They started to discredit it. They started to call it a heretical cult, started to really push back on it because they saw that it, in their eyes, the Communist Party saw that it was a threat to their security. Now, this ultimately reached its zenith, this tension reached its zenith in 1999, when 20,000 Falun Gong practitioners protested outside of the CCP's headquarters in Beijing. And so that was the last straw. And much like the Tiananmen Square massacre, what followed was a severe crackdown on the practitioners of Falun Gong. According to a report that I've linked in the description here, 600 practitioners were forced into mental institutions, 10,000 were forced into re-education camps, and 50,000 were held temporarily with the threat of torture and an unknown release date, an unknown point of release from capture and from imprisonment. And I have a testimony from here as well. Let me pull this back here. it said, where is this quote? I had it not too long ago. Yes, okay. People are drugged with various unknown kinds of medication, tied with ropes to hospital beds, subjected to electroconvulsive therapy or painful forms of electrical acupuncture treatment, denied adequate food and water, forced to write confessional statements renouncing their belief in Falun Gong as a precondition of their eventual release, and then are required to pay fines for their board and treatment in the hospital. And so that's just some of the things that were going on from 1999 to 2001. All of those numbers that I mentioned were just 2001 numbers. Who knows what's gone on since. And this has been seen as such a gross violation of human rights internationally that Spanish and Argentinian courts have indicted top CCP officials for torture and genocide of Falun Gong practitioners. Now, that's not something that's thrown around lightly. The G word, as in genocide, is something that is very serious. And to have two courts from two different countries levy that claim must mean that it's significant. And so I'm not going to put any kind of values on this particular story. I'm not going to put in my own personal opinion, simply because it's a very complicated, nuanced issue, and I'm just going to relate the facts as they are now. You have the Falun Dafa, a group that has been persecuted by the Chinese Communist Party and tortured its practitioners on one end, and then you have the Chinese Communist Party on the other. And they're two forces that are actively working against each other. The Falun Dafa movement, they work to try and garner international support for their human rights advocacy, and Shen Yun is a way of doing that. And the Chinese Communist Party, on the other hand, tries to discredit Shen Yun and Falun Dafa by sort of, again, using the labels of cult, some religious thing where it's really just a meditation. And so it's very interesting as well to me, too, because the Shen Yun advertisement, as I've said, I'm going to bring it back to this, it's inherently political. And especially when you look at it in the context of this backstory, it really creates a much more complete experience. And it really gives you a better understanding of why Falun Dafa says what they say and why they do what they do. So I think this should be a nice case study for all of you listening here, to really take a second look at literally anything in your life, and really consider, what went into this? What's the story behind this? What power structures does this thing I'm thinking about promote? What power structures does this attack and sort of shove under the rug? What is the political story? And what is the historical story behind this thing, whatever it may be in your life? Because I'm telling you, every single thing in this world has a political background to it, and it's on all of us to do our own research and to learn that story so we can make the most informed decisions as to what we do next.